Okay, I think it's about 4 o'clock, so we'll begin. I'm not showing any slides or PowerPoint today, so if people want more lighting, they can open the shades behind them. But I'm pleased to be able to be here with the door open so we can get some cool breezes through here. Anyway, I'm John Marty. I'm here at Holden for one of many times teaching and talking and sharing in these sessions on some public policy issues and so on. For background, I've been a state senator in Minnesota for a very long time, 30 plus years now, and enjoy these conversations and chance to talk about some of the issues that we as a society ought to be addressing. And the topic today, I think it was titled Law Enforcement and Black Lives Matter, and wanted to talk about this, one, because it's an issue I've been involved in, and two, because last summer, a year ago, it was in my district, my legislative district, that Philando Castillo, who made national news, was killed by a police officer, a man who was stopped for a traffic light out, and he, I think most of you know, but he informed the officer he has a permit to carry, which is usually what people are instructed to do, and within a few seconds he was dead. And there was no conviction in the case. It's not a surprise. But the same day that that killing occurred in Minnesota, another killing by a police officer, in this case of a mentally ill man, occurred in February, a few months earlier, and the day of that killing, the local prosecutor announced he was not going to bring charges against the officer in that case. And that case is not one that made national news. Both of them have the distinction of having lots of similar cases. The Castillo one made attention because it was so clearly done and because the girlfriend of Philando Castillo filmed it from within seconds after it happening, and people were very much horrified by it. And these things raise two issues I wanted to raise in this, and I wasn't sure how to title it, but Law Enforcement and Black Lives Matter. I wanted to get two issues. One is the issue of police training, and two, the issue of racial bias in the system. And it was really helpful for me to juxtapose these two together. I went to some of the marches the day of Castillo's killing. People were... huge crowds of people came together for a vigil at the school where he worked and marched from there to the governor's residence to have a long protest. And it was moving when they were saying his name, giving dignity to the person who was killed, Philando Castillo, Philando Castillo, struck me as a very powerful and moving thing. And the other chants, of course, there were one, no justice, no peace, and prosecute the police, which are important things to talk about as well, but in a sense, there are different sides of it. And what I was trying to get across to people then and now is I'm far less interested in a prosecution. It's important that people be prosecuted for doing wrong. It's very important to do that. But the main thing I want to see us do going forward is make it so there are fewer of these people killed. And to give a little more detail, because most of you have heard of the Philando Castillo one, many of you saw the videos, many of you saw everything that happened there. But in the other case, a man named John Birkeland, he was a 50-some-year-old man with paranoid schizophrenia, volunteered, and he was unemployed at the time, but he had worked many times. He volunteered, he had no kids of his own, but his family, a family of 6 or 7 siblings, and all of their kids, all they thought he was their favorite uncle. He was a very caring person. Anyway, one night that February, some of his neighbors in his apartment building called police because there was a lot of noise coming from his apartment, a disturbance, and they wanted to do a welfare check on him. The police in my home community of Roseville, who were where the incident occurred, they responded to it. They knew he was mentally ill. They had many previous calls to his apartment. And in this case, they come to the door and they knock on the door and he's crying and they're having a conversation while he's crying. A few minutes later, he started yelling at them. A few minutes later, he went silent and they're trying to talk to him through the door. They called him up and everything and they said, look, if you don't come out, we're going to come in. This is a welfare check. They're supposed to be helping make sure he's okay. Somehow, one of the multiple officers decided it might be a good idea to have a police dog in there. And so after 20 minutes, they break down the door, five officers and a dog, on a man who is in paranoid schizophrenic, probably intoxicated on either alcohol or some other substance, and cowering in his closet. They go in, search the apartment. If you don't come out, we're coming in after you. I don't know about you, but if a German Shepherd police dog was coming after me and they're telling me he's coming to get you, I'd be scared even if I didn't have paranoia, even if I didn't have any other challenge. In any case, within a few seconds of when they got to the room where he was in the closet, the dog went in. He had bites all over his leg. The dog was stabbed, and he was dead. The police shot him multiple times. And I told the family, I had met with them earlier, I was working on some legislation trying to get more police training to deal with mental health issues and de-escalation. I told the family, I don't mean to be harsh or rude or anything like that, but I really am not nearly as bothered by the decision not to prosecute as I'm bothered by the fact that the police chief said he thinks his officers did a great job and they're well-trained in mental health issues. They're well-trained, they did a great job, and I did notice in the paper this year they commended them, giving them some sort of medals of whatever for doing a great job in that case. Two of those officers apparently had been involved in shooting another mentally ill man a couple years earlier. And it hit me that a lot of the issues, and the reason I wanted to talk about racial disparities and so on is not to suggest that in the Castillo case or anything else, the issue is simply a matter of police training, because it's more than that. But I also wanted to say that it's very important we look at the training and how it's done and what happens. I was trying to make the case that I think the police need to do a better job of de-escalating in those sort of situations. And I found somebody who articulated very nicely, a former Minneapolis Star Tribune newspaper reporter, retired guy, who wrote a commentary a few months later after Jamar Clark, who was another one of the African-American men shot in that case by Minneapolis police a bit earlier than that, 6 months or a year earlier. And he wrote a thing the day after the Minneapolis police chief and Minneapolis mayor announced that they were not going to discipline the officers who killed Jamar Clark. They did nothing wrong, there was nothing to discipline him in, and so on. And he wrote a piece that really hit the nail on the head in my mind, and he talked about, I'll quote briefly what he wrote. The root of the problem is the story has two halves, and public officials, federal, state, and local, have spent their time and energy on the second half. That's the half that began when the cops and Jamar Clark were tussling on the ground. Clark reached for an officer's holstered gun. The officers, fearing for their lives, decided to shoot Clark before he could shoot them. That decision, terrible as it was, seems justified. That's why the officers are now free men. That's why they were not prosecuted criminally. But this retired reporter in a commentary is saying, but what about the first half of the time? First half, however, the confrontational half, largely overlooked, was even more important for future police work. The fact is the officers took a calm situation, recklessly turned it into combat. Otherwise, the shooting would not have occurred. His points. The officers moved quickly against Clark, even though by the time they arrived, the 24-year-old was standing out of the way with hands in his jacket pockets on a November night, causing no trouble. He wasn't totally innocent. He pestered two ambulance attendants as they cared for a 41-year-old woman for whom Clark seemed to have some affinity. He writes, quote, interfering was too strong of a word. Clark never laid a hand on the attendants. They nevertheless got unnerved and called police. By the time the cops arrived, the woman had been loaded into the ambulance, the doors locked, any danger had passed. Officers showed no concern for keeping peace on the street, which could reasonably be considered their first responsibility. Instead, they risked confronting a solitary black man in full view of a gathering crowd on a late Saturday night on Plymouth Avenue, a busy street in North Minneapolis. Cops could have stepped back and kept watch on the ambulance, but their priorities were otherwise. One officer could be seen in a video pulling on a pair of tight, dark gloves ready for action as they strode toward Clark. All this information can be found in videos, et cetera, et cetera. Officers didn't place Clark under arrest, didn't tell them why they were giving orders and getting rough with him. They told him to take his hands out of his pockets, which he ignored, Even after they pulled his hands out of his pockets and found no weapons, the cops persisted in subduing their suspect, which needed no subduing. But Clark, drunk and stubborn, wouldn't hold still for handcuffs. So Officer Ruggenberg pulled him down. And I think that's the whole thing. In the case of the mentally ill man, they know he's there, he's struggling, they know he's got an illness, they know something else. And yet the thing is, rather than say, let's leave well enough alone or call in some mental health experts to come in and intervene, people who are willing to do it, and there are volunteer programs even for mental health people in Minnesota and a lot of places to help, rather than call them in, we know what we're doing, they're not the experts, we're the experts in policing. And they go in and a few minutes later, somebody's dead. And you can't really second guess them once somebody's stabbing somebody and attacking their dog, whether he attacked the dog or the dog attacked him first, we'll never know. But why you go there with five officers on a mentally ill man is a real question. And I think the same thing happens here. The same thing happened in Jamar Clark. Why do you escalate it so quickly when the training for cops is supposed to be the opposite? I remember I worked in criminal justice politically 30 plus years ago, and Minnesota was one of the first states. We were proud of our law enforcement training. I think we were the first state in the country to have a professionalized police department, Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, which I think most states now have. Probably every state now has. We required them to all be licensed and trained before they could do it. And I remember many times when they talked about deadly force, which is what they're doing with guns, and how it was the last resort. And they said, it's not firearms training, it's not using firearms training. The first thing we do is how not to do it. I remember a display, early technology, where they had a big screen and they'd have a scenario put there and they'd give you a gun that was electronically going to do it, and you were supposed to shoot if you thought it was a dangerous situation. They'd come there in a dark alley or something, and it'd be one situation, be a little old lady unloading groceries. Another one, it would be somebody who might be shooting you. And it's amazing how many times the people who were being run through this test would be stepping up and shooting innocent people. And they said that the whole point of the training is always to make sure you're not using deadly force. In recent years, that has come to change in many ways, not just in terms of the lack of training for de-escalation and calming things down, which has been highlighted heavily in the mental health community. I think most states probably have mental health people who have been working on retraining police to do this. But in our country, we have all kinds of training that the head of the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training, national organization, or international, I guess it says, in Washington, D.C., the executive director of it describes some of the courses that law enforcement officers go through as paranoia training. One of the ones that was called out in this case was a seminar called Bulletproof Warrior. Instructors urge law enforcement officers conference to make the decision to shoot if they ever feel their lives are threatened. Videos of bloody shootouts between police and civilians emphasize the key point. Hesitation can kill you. And this is from a newspaper article. In the audience of that May 2014 seminar was a young St. Anthony police officer, Geronimo Yanez, city records show. He's the one who shot Philando Castile. And the question is, why are we training our officers in something that may be called paranoia training? They have some of the most dangerous work you can possibly have. But if you go there thinking, this guy might kill me if I don't shoot him first, you're going to have a lot of dead people. And so I want to say a couple more things about this and move into the other issue, the racial issues. But that's not a problem in just a few cases. It's a problem all over the place. I thought there was a really interesting story last fall. A police officer was fired for not shooting a mentally ill man. In the town of Weirton, West Virginia, the city terminated the officer who did not fire at a man with a gun. And I'll just read briefly from that news story there. After responding to a report of a domestic incident on May 6th in Weirton, West Virginia, then Weirton police officer Stephen Mader found himself confronting an armed man. And this Stephen Mader was apparently an Iraqi war vet, which you'd picture some of the folks who come in from the military might be hypersensitive and ready to shoot at first instinct. But I've talked to so many military folks who have come back who are now in policing who say, no, the military spends much more effort training you when not to shoot than we seem to be training police officers. Anyhow, this veteran coming back confronted our man. Immediately, the training he had undergone as a Marine to look at the whole person in deciding if someone was a terrorist, as well as his situational police academy training, kicked in, and he did not shoot. I saw he had a gun, but it was not pointed at me, Mr. Mader recalled, noting the silver handgun was in the man's right hand, hanging at his side and pointed at the ground. Mr. Mader, who was standing behind Mr. Williams' car parked on the street, said he then began to use my calm voice. I told him, put down the gun. He's like, just shoot me. I told him, I'm not going to shoot you, brother. Then he starts flicking his wrist to get me to react to it. I thought I was going to be able to talk to him and de-escalate him. I knew it was a suicide by cop situation. The guy's telling him to shoot him. But just then, two other Weirton officers arrived at the scene. Mr. Williams walked toward them, waving his gun, later found out to be unloaded, between them and Mr. Mader, and one of them shot Mr. Williams in the back of the head, just behind his right ear, killing him. Anyhow, the officer, a month later, 2 months later, was terminated from his job. And they said, well, no, it wasn't for that. It was, at first they told him he put other officers in jeopardy at doing that. But in any case, they fired him. I was thinking maybe they'd think, maybe the other officers overreacted. Maybe when you're dealing with a mentally ill man, because mentally ill people can do dangerous things. And in a crisis like that, we actually have officers who are fired for doing what I think most of us would say the right approach for officers should be. What do we do about this? I had, before the Philando Castillo thing, after this one individual was killed, I had introduced a bill that required that all Minnesota peace officers would, within 3 or 4 years, have to have at least 4 hours of this mental health training. The standard in Minnesota is 40 hours for it, and like one of the officers in the Roseville department who shot the mentally ill man had that 40-hour training. And I'm thinking maybe 40 hours isn't sufficient. Certainly 4 hours may be not enough. But the bottom line message of that should be people with mental illness need a calming sense. They need somebody who can come and relate to the situation in a peaceful way and start moving them away from it. So I think we have to find a way, and I do think that this relates very much to the Castillo case and to the Jamar Clark case. As that columnist said, why can't you back off a little bit? Wait and see. You don't go about it. Take your hands out of your pockets if you don't react fast enough. I've said so, and you ignore. You get ignored. You decide, well, I've got two of us. We're armed. We don't know if you are or not. You might be, so we'll wrestle you to the ground. And again, I think the columnist hit it right. Once they're on the ground wrestling, you can't blame them for, in the end, if somebody's reaching for your gun to say, I'm going to have to do something. But why did it come from a, in a sense, a situation that didn't have to escalate, and why did it go there? So the idea of retraining police, I wanted to have a thing. I think the city of Houston, Texas, has banned officers, has banned city funding, at least, from paying for the what we might call paranoia training. The Bulletproof Warrior course, because of a lot of bad press, has changed its name. I'm not sure what the name of the program is, but it's a for-profit institution training officers in what, again, the head of the Police Training Institute in Washington called paranoia training. So I think we have to look at that. I also, both banning the paranoia stuff and providing the right kind of training, community policing type of things, almost every police department says how that's their goal. What worries me is how many think they're doing that and they're sending in situations where there don't have to be killings. But then I also want to get to the second half of it, and that is the racial issue of it. Implicit bias, and when we talk about bias, when we talk about implicit racism or something, all of a sudden our hackles get up and, wait a minute, I'm not a racist. George Wallace in the 1960s, he was a racist. These Southern segregationists, they were racist. I'm not a racist. So every time the word racist is used, it becomes one that is hard to hard for people to see anything other than they're being under attack for being a bad person. And yet, I think we know more and more about how each of us has these biases. And I wanted to I want to make a pitch, a strong pitch, if anybody has a chance. I checked, I didn't see it in the library here, a book by law professor Michelle Alexander, I think it came out about 2010 or so, called The New Jim Crow. I want to actually quote some things from it. I want to highly quote it. She was riding a bus somewhere. She worked for NAACP Legal Defense or something in California. She was riding on a bus one day and she saw a sign that said, mass incarceration or the drug war, the new Jim Crow. And she thought, well, yeah, there may be some similarities, but it's really overkill to say that. And she started thinking and doing more whatever analysis of it, and she wrote a heavily documented book later on when she kind of concluded that's exactly what we're doing. We had slavery for a long time. When slavery was gone, the Jim Crow laws took it. It's always putting down, in this case, the African-American community were treated as less than human. They were treated as less than human as slaves, and after that, in Jim Crow, less than human, less than equal, and everything else. And in the 60s, when Jim Crow laws went away and so on, she says, and I think the reason I want you to encourage you to read the book is it was so powerful in I'd have trouble believing you could read the book and not come away thinking our system is, whether intentionally or not, designed in a very racist manner. She quotes a study that was used in one appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court in a life imprisonment term for an African-American man in Georgia who was saying they did all the legal research. There are twice as many white folks in Georgia as African-Americans. They use drugs at a higher level than African-Americans. Yet 98.4% of the life sentences for drug use were African-Americans. And she goes into every step of the way how our system is biased. In terms of stops, I mean, police go, well, we're going to go with the high-risk neighborhoods, the ghettos. We're going to go here. We're going to do that. When they said that, actually, when you look at white high schools, kids sharing drugs, selling small doses of drugs to each other for spending money or whatever is more common than it is among African-American community doing that. She quotes numerous studies around the country showing that that's the case. So in effect, there are twice as many white folks in Georgia who are using drugs at not a lot higher, but somewhat higher usage rate than African-American community is, and yet almost 98.5% of the life sentences are going to African-American men. And the courts have said no, unless you can show, unless somebody says, I'm prosecuting him because he's black, unless you can get somebody to say something that way, they basically close the doors to anybody trying to do it. Warrantless searches. I mean, the idea of stopping cars on any pretense to say we want to search for drugs. And the courts have said, well, yeah, you don't need a warrant. You can do a search as long as you get their consent. Well, if an officer stops your car and you're black and you whatever, and they say, I'd like to search your car, they've done studies of how many people of any race are willing to say, no, please don't. And even though they don't tell you have a right to a lawyer, they don't say anything else, but how many do? And it's almost automatic. I mean, it's a guaranteed way to do it. And you get people stopped and you check them for drugs. And so you have higher numbers there, you have higher numbers of people being prosecuted. Every step of the way, it does it. And then she goes through how once you get the conviction, you're in trouble because you cannot. Bill Clinton had a thing, one strike and you're out for public housing. You have any drug conviction ever on your record. And actually, it doesn't have to be a conviction, but you have a drug arrest on your record. You cannot get in public housing later. You probably can't get a job once you got a felony record on your thing. You got all sorts of other things. We trap more and more people, which is why you get the huge percentages of African-American men who can't participate in the court, in the vote, in the electoral system, who can't participate in society in any way. They are trapped. The sweeps for drugs in community, the stops and searches. I want to read a couple of things in the book because you kind of think, well, you know, but you know, they did something wrong. There's a reason they're being prosecuted. They did something wrong. I never do anything wrong. And she actually quotes how in the 90s when a terrible DWI drunk driver killed 27 people in a bus accident, and how people spontaneously got involved. We got to change the laws. She said, if you are driving under the influence, you are far more dangerous to society than somebody who uses small amount of drugs. And she points out how we're going after the small users, not the big users, because they, in order to get more information from them, you plea bargain, they get lesser sentences, everything else. But one of the things she hit on was that sometimes innocent people are convicted too. I'm going to just try and read this, a couple paragraphs. Imagine you're Emma Faye Stewart, 30-year-old, single, African and mother, American mother of two, who was arrested as part of a drug sweep in Harn, Texas. All but one of the people arrested were African American. You are innocent. After a week in jail, you have no one to care for your two small children and are eager to get home. Your court-appointed attorney urges you to plead guilty to a drug distribution charge, saying the prosecution has offered probation. You refuse, steadfastly proclaiming your innocence. Finally, after almost a month in jail, you decide to plead guilty so you can return home to your children. Unwilling to risk a trial and years of imprisonment, you are sentenced to 10 years probation, ordered to pay $1,000 in fines, as well as court and probation costs. You are also now branded a drug felon. You are no longer eligible for food stamps. You may be discriminated against in employment. You cannot vote for at least 12 years, and you're about to be evicted from public housing. Once homeless, your children will be taken from you and put in foster care. A judge eventually dismisses all cases against the defendants who did not plead guilty. At trial, the judge finds the entire sweep was based on the testimony of a single informant who had lied to the prosecution. You, however, are still a drug felon, homeless and desperate to regain the custody of your children. Do you think that happens in our country? We don't want to say that. We don't want to believe it because it's so bizarre. And we keep thinking, you know, how has it happened? Because one step after another. I worked several years ago on a poverty commission, a commission designed to see what we could do to end poverty, which I think we actually could do if we put our will, our minds to it. But what you'd find out is a parent who is struggling to pay the bills, their car breaks down. So they have to take their kid to childcare by bus before they get to work. And the bus is late. And then they lose their job and they lose this. And how things that any one of us could overcome, a little barrier, you find out, well, you overcome one barrier with support and other family members who can help you. But you have one hit after another hit after another hit. And she points out how that's the way our criminal justice system tends to act and how it tends to deal with people. And so the next one I wanted to quickly read was something about debtor's prison, something that we don't think occurs anymore. We got rid of debtor's prison. You cannot go to prison for lack of money. That was something the Charles Dickens era had, but we don't have that problem. She says, 2/3 of people detained in jails report annual incomes under $12,000 prior to arrest. Predictably, most ex-offenders find themselves unable to pay many of the fees, costs, and fines associated with their imprisonment, as well as their child support debts, which continue to accumulate while a person is incarcerated. As a result, many ex-offenders have their paychecks garnished. Federal law provides child support enforcement officer can garnish up to 2/3 of an individual's wages for child support. On top of that, probation officers in most states can require the individual dedicate 35% of his or her income to the payment of fines, fees, surcharges, and restitution charged by various agencies. Accordingly, a former inmate living at or below the poverty level can be charged 4 or 5 departments at once and can be required to surrender 100% of his earnings, his or her earnings. As the New York Times editorial observed, people caught in this impossible predicament are less likely to seek regular employment, making them even more susceptible to criminal relapse. Some offenders, like Ora Lee Hurley, find themselves trapped by fees and fines in prison. Hurley was a prisoner held at the Gateway Diversion Center in Atlanta in 2006. She was imprisoned because she owed a $705 fine. As part of the diversion program, she was permitted to work during the day and return to the center at night. 5 days a week, she worked full-time at a restaurant, earning $6.50 an hour, and after taxes, netted about $700 a month. Room and board at the diversion center was about $600, and her monthly transportation cost $52. Miscellaneous other expenses, including clothes and shoes and personal items such as toothpaste, quickly exhausted what was left. Her attorney decried the trap she was in. This is a situation where if this woman was able to write a check for the amount of fine, she would be out of there. And because she can't, she's still in custody. It's as simple as that. Although she worked a full-time job while in custody, most of her income went to repay the diversion program, not the underlying fine that put her in custody in the first place. And they talk about back in the pre-Civil War days when freed slaves were whatever, they'd trap them in another way and they'd get them back into a debtor's society where they'd go to prison and they'd work off their debt at a wage that you could never make it. We don't think that happens. We don't believe it happens. And I'm going to tell one final story of this thing, and I want to open it up in a couple of minutes. But chokeholds, I mean, these are all penalties, locking somebody up and so on. But the Supreme Court has put it in such a way that some offenses that most of us, if we're arrested by the police or something, we're not likely to be put in a chokehold. We're not likely to suffer from that. But again, there's a lot of bias in the system. And she writes about a guy named Adolph Lyon's attempt to ban the use of lethal chokeholds by the Los Angeles Police Department. It's a good example. Lyon's, a 24-year-old black man, was driving his car in Los Angeles one morning when he was pulled over by four white officers for a burned-out taillight. With guns drawn, police ordered Lyon's out of his car. He obeyed. Officers told him to face the car, spread his legs, and put his hands on his head. Again, Lyon's did as he was told. After the officers completed a pat-down, Lyons dropped his hands, prompting an officer to slam his hands back on his head. When Lyons complained that the car keys he was holding were causing him pain, the officer forced Lyons into a chokehold. He lost consciousness and collapsed. When he awoke, he was spitting up blood and dirt, had urinated and defecated, and suffered permanent damage to his larynx. Officers issued a traffic ticket for the burned-out taillight and released him. Lyon sued the city of Los Angeles for violation of his constitutional rights and sought as a remedy a ban against future use of the chokeholds. By the time his case reached the Supreme Court, 16 people had been killed by police use of the chokehold, 12 of them black men. Supreme Court dismissed the case, however, ruling Lyons lacked the standing to seek an injunction against the deadly practice. In order to have standing, the court reasoned, Lyons would have to show he was highly likely to be subject to a chokehold again. He didn't have standing because he couldn't show he was not likely to have it happen again. He argued that as a black man, he had good reason to fear he would be stopped by the police for a minor traffic violation and subjected to a chokehold again. He had done nothing to provoke the chokehold. Contrary, he had obeyed instructions, cooperated fully. Why wouldn't he believe he was at risk of being stopped and choked again? The court, however, ruled that in order to have standing, he would not only had to allege he would have another encounter with the police, but to make the incredible assertion that either that one, all the police officers in Los Angeles always choke any citizen with whom they have an encounter, or for the purpose of arrest, issuing a citation, or for questioning, and two, that the city ordered or authorized the police to act in such manner. He has no choice. The reason I wanted to go into those so much is because when I've been working on law enforcement training issues, I'm trying to say, and I think we're all trying to say, we want to break down these barriers in the community. I actually thought it might be helpful to talk about mental health crises and killings of black men by police officers. And the idea that you could say, hey, there's a way we can address this because we have to de-escalate the situation. And I think that's all exactly the case. I think it's very true. But it's very important that we don't blow off the other situation, the fact that our system is something we don't want to admit, but it's set up in a way that it is discriminatory. And in one of the cases, I think it was on the death penalty, in which a case went to the U.S. Supreme Court and was arguing that it was applied in a discriminatory manner, the court ruled, in effect, they said, she quoted, I thought it was an outrageous thing for her to allege in the book, but she said the court was basically saying that if they let this case go forward, it could throw out our whole justice system. And then she puts a quote from the court's majority finding saying basically that giving this credence would underlie the very foundations of our criminal justice system. In other words, she was saying, if we acknowledge that there might be bias here, it's saying all the things in that make us believe in our criminal justice system would be gone. And we as a very white audience. We as a very white community, we don't see this in the same way. So I think it's something that when we talk about policing, and I want to open it up in a minute, but I want to say that as we look at it, the biggest issue, the one we want to avoid, is we don't want more killings. We don't want police killing people in any situation unless it's an absolute last resort, which is what training used to be about. But if you are training officers who are afraid, this Geronimo Yanez, he worked in another city's police department, also happened to be a city in my district. All of those folks, he may be a very good person. I know the mayor of that community. I know the city council members. I know lots of the residents in the community. They're good people. They care. But somehow or another, we're accepting officers who have either come in there with a paranoia, a fear, or they've developed one in their training, which puts innocent lives at risk. And that's why, again, Castillo's case, yeah, he had a light out. I had an intern last year who got involved, decided he was a math major at Grinnell, decided to switch his major to political science after this killing because he lived in Falcon Heights, the city where the killing was. And his brother did a study of police stops in Falcon Heights, and they found out that I think African-American men were more than 10 times as likely to be stopped as whites, even disparity between who lives in the community or not. But how many of us have had our cars stopped 5 or 10 times in the last 5, 10 years for lights out or where you get a warning, well, you switch lanes without your turn signal or whatever, the pretext for doing something else. In Castillo's case, it was he looked like he might be a guy who was involved in a robbery a few weeks earlier nearby. And this is at night, African-American man. I don't know that I could distinguish two people in a driver's seat in a car driving past. But it's a huge issue. We have to deal with both the training and the acknowledgement of something that we as a society have been unwilling to do. And there is recognize that we are not a society that treats people equally. And with that, I'm going to make one final pitch before opening it for discussion to encourage you to read the book. It's called The New Jim Crow. It's not a new book. It's about 7, 8 years old. But I was one of my staff members last year after the Castillo killing said, John, you got to read that book. It's my favorite. I don't know if favorite is the right word for the book, but it's my favorite book. It was the most powerful book she had read in a long time. And I had to read it and did read it. And wow. Anyway, with that, I want to open up for discussion about things, either about what you've experienced in terms of what you're feeling when these incidents come out. How do we feel? How do we try and do something in our own communities? And how do we stop it from becoming a war where the police feel they're being picked on because somebody's challenging them? And, I mean, we get to the Black Lives Matter. Well, no, every life matters. Well, every life does matter. Blue lives matter. Black lives matter. But when you see the numbers, you see why. Again, how many times we've had these stories, the Trayvon Martin case, where innocent people are gunned down by, in many cases, private citizens who are using their stand your ground laws or whatever to do it, which again gets into the gun issues again. But I think we got to look at those. So I'll open it up for Chris. You want to begin?
Just an interesting addition to what you said about Michelle Alexander. She was a lawyer and professor at a law school and began giving talks about this book, The New Jim Crow, in church basements, anywhere where someone would hear her talk about it, crowds of 2, 5, 7 people. And it mushroomed into this phenomenon, the book did, and became very influential. But she, in the process of the book gaining traction and attention, came to the conviction that the real place where change was going to take place was with people's hearts, and that the place to address that was through faith and morality. And so she left her tenured position at her law school and is doing a 3-year residency at Union Theological Seminary in New York in order to to explore spirituality and avenues to change our society from the perspective of a change of heart, a change of that's rooted in something larger than ourselves, larger than just in presenting the facts, which, as you pointed out, the book presents the facts really powerfully.
Yes.
But she's convinced that just presenting the facts is not, in fact, going to create the change she wants. So it's just interesting, especially in the context of Bolden, to wonder how faith plays a role in potentially opening up the kind of changes she's arguing and you're arguing for.
I did not know she had gone to Union. Thank you for passing on. And she makes the point, too, that unlike slavery and unlike Jim Crow, this one's going to be a harder one. Because in those cases, it's pretty hard not to see, well, we are only enslaving people of this race. We are only discriminating against people of this race. It was very clear in all the wording, not all the wording, but a lot of it. She does make the case that, well, these things aren't this drug sentencing laws, which the prison population has grown about 1,100% in the last 30, 40 years, that is almost 100% of that growth has been caused, not by higher crime rates, but by tougher drug laws. And she can say, and those are, she starts out by saying those are not explicitly race-based, but then she points out the poll tax in the South wasn't explicitly race-based either. It was the discretionary enforcement. Everybody had to pay the poll tax if the person running the polling place required it. But it was facially neutral laws that were twisted that way. But in this case, it's hard to argue. They're saying these laws are discriminating. The way they're being implemented are discriminating. So you're right, the changing hearts is going to be especially hard. Yes?
So I don't live in Minnesota, so I don't know all the details, but I know there was a recent shooting in Minneapolis where an innocent Australian woman was gunned down by a police officer, and at the end of the day, the mayor asked the police chief to resign. So I'm curious for your thoughts on that. Do you think that happened because the woman who was killed was white? Was this after a whole chain of events in the Minneapolis police force? What happened there?
It's a good question. Did everybody hear about that situation? Do you remember? That was not that long before I came here. And so I have not, and I've been kind of out of touch on what's been going on in the last couple of weeks. But yes, the police chief was asked to step down. And again, there's a whole lot of issues related to that. I hope it wasn't because this was a white woman. This was an international incident in this case, so I frankly think the rest of them were international incidents too. Gary Mason last week from Northern Ireland, who was speaking here last week, made the case about how Hitler actually quoted the way we treated African Americans in Mein Kampf and other things, is how we learned to subject, it was the Jim Crow, so how we could segregate different people away. That was part of his thing, and I keep thinking, really? I never knew that. I didn't know that was part of our teaching others. But this case, the Australian government and everybody, international crisis, an innocent Australian woman gets gunned down for doing nothing, for reporting a crime. And I don't know. I think the police chief, I think it's some sort of thing at a certain point, you have to do something. The mayor felt you had to do something. I think the police chief, I would argue, that like in the failure to discipline those officers for the example I gave earlier about the Jamar Clark case, I think it was reasonable to terminate it. I hope it was not, and I think the mayor and others are highly sensitive to racial stuff right now. I think it certainly doesn't look good, though, when black people get killed, a white woman gets killed, and all of a sudden we have action, but it may have been, in this case, the straw that broke the camel's back kind of thing, too, I hope.
The system has so many components to it because it's city, state, federal law. In Georgia, they can hold somebody in the local jail for up to a year before they give them a speedy trial. Mm-hmm. The sheriff can put them to work, but they don't get paid. I'm a former prosecutor, and as I left my career, one of the incidences that used to bother me was a high percentage of Hispanics being picked up, accused of drugs, and it was right before their speedy trial in Washington. We have 90 days, so,
okay.
You know, like 88th day was the trial date. So on the 86th day, we used to get back the test results, and it was like non-drug. So
86 days later,
they would have it because of the state laboratory system.
Right.
And you
backed
for the trial. So that was fast track. And then I, when I was leaving my prosecution period, I asked the local state patrol chief, you know, what's going on here? And he was straight up, Terry, there's some people we don't want here, and this is the way we do it. Now, how do you make that actionable?
Right.
It's a whole system thing. So the, you know, highlighting how it's economically or race-based is important for changing the system.
Right.
Because like those fines that you talk about, you can get them on traffic tickets. If you don't make your $5, $10 a month, you hit a high interest rate, and a private company takes that over.
Do you have private companies doing it in Washington, too? Because, I mean, I know it happens in a lot of states.
Yeah. So it's an economic and it's a race-based thing.
Right.
But how do you change it? Because
right.
There's so many components to it.
I'm curious. I mean, the individual who said there's some people we don't want here. I mean, getting that kind of quote is the kind of thing that seems to me you would hope that would get the courts to say, well, we got to stop this, that there's a racist system in place. But I wouldn't count on it either. You're asking the same questions I am. How do we make this change happen? Where were you? In Western Washington? Or?
Yeah, I was in what's called Cowlitz County, and then I also prosecuted for the Pinault Indian Nation.
Oh, okay.
Now,
thank you for sharing. I wish I had it. Maybe others have better ideas, but thank you for sharing that story. Yes.
Sorry, just kind of piggybacking off of that, we actually had something in the, I'm from Texas, we had something in the state legislature that was along the effects of if you get traffic violations, if you can't afford it, then that you shouldn't be getting a fine, you shouldn't be being held. But the state legislature decided not to do that because they don't want these people in the streets.
Right.
And so I think that it really is kind of a systemic issue in the sense that I feel like people are afraid for no reason.
When we're talking about that kind of thing, the issue of undocumented immigrant driver's licenses. Minnesota, we've had a big fight because the former governor said, okay, we're not going to, by basically executive order type of thing, change the policy so undocumented folks couldn't get driver's licenses anymore. Current governor says he wants to change, he didn't want to change it first, but now later in his term, he's saying, yeah, he's willing to change that, but he needs legal permission from the legislature to do it. Previous governor didn't need to do it one way to do it, but the issue, the reason that matters so much, immigrant lawyers, is they're saying that's the justification to pick people out of their home and send them back, even if they're parents, even if you may have 1,000 reasons not to send them back, is that a lot of these folks, they broke the law. They drove without a license. They broke the law, and that's the pretext for sending back a lot of people who are otherwise law-abiding every way they can. But what you say is, yeah, it happens in so many different ways. Yes?
Wasn't it in Ferguson that they found a precursor to the uprising was all the traffic tickets that was they were using as a funding mechanism,
right.
And it was almost like a debtor's kind of situation.
Right.
And now they've stepped in with the federal, but they're fighting that, and there's now with the new administration, they're talking about dropping any of the federal oversight. And where's that going to go?
Right. I mean, the whole thing, this whole debtor's prison issue is, we got rid of that once, but it's coming back more and more every year. I mean, in Minnesota, one of the funding things, rather than taxes, let's have bad people pay for things, so we put all these huge fines and surcharges on anything. Anybody going to court for any reason, we finally this year had a Republican committee chair who was saying, you know, these filing fees, $300 for somebody for a small filing, a little dispute, they have to pay 300 some bucks for this or anything related to divorce or things like that. $300 filing fee. Can't we start bringing those down? Because we're trapping people who can least afford it.
I'd like to first give you my background. I, until very recently, was married to a Latino woman. I have two stepdaughters who are half African. Now I'd like to ask a question. How many police officers do we have in here?
I'm not hearing the question.
Yes, if anybody here is a police officer. One over here.
One. How many of you have had someone try to take your life, shoot at you? I have. I'm a combat veteran from Vietnam. I know what a police officer is feeling when he faces a gun. 2.5 years ago, a police officer in the city of Madison was called to a situation where a young man was running in the street. This young man assaulted 3 people, then exited into his friend's apartment. His friend called 911, asking for someone to come and assist you. Police officer responded. He did not wait for backup. He began entering the apartment. On his way up the stairs in a dark apartment after dark, was assaulted by this young man who was coming out of the apartment, who was tearing the apartment apart, and he took his life. There were riots in the city of Madison. Within 2.5 miles of my house, by the way, that young man was African American. He was on marijuana, he was on mushrooms, and he was out of control. The family settled for $2.3 million in a civil case. Less than 2 weeks after that, not 2.5 miles from my house, another black man was shot and killed, this time by another black man. Not one word from Black Lives Matter. This year in the city of Madison, Wisconsin, when I left August 3rd, we had reached the maximum number of homicides in the city that we have ever had. 10th homicide had occurred. 10th homicides, black on black. Legislature in the city of the state of Wisconsin has tried to pass legislation to allow concealed carry, to allow open carry with absolutely no training, no license. Our police officers are up against a war. Having been shot at, having known that there was someone there willing to take my life, I believe that I have an understanding of what a police officer has, his feeling is, what's going on inside of his body and inside of his brain when he approaches someone that he believes to have a gun. Now, you cited someone standing with the weapon at their side. I think that police officers have been trained to know that before they can respond, if someone has a gun in their hand, they're likely to be able to be faster at taking your life than you are taking theirs. I don't question anything that you have had. I think all of what you have read, all of what you have pointed out is absolutely correct. But I think there's another side to this. And I think we have to be conscious of both sides if we're going to try to find something where we can meet in the middle.
I think you were very good to point out, one, to ask if there are other peace officers in the room, two, if people have ever been shot at, and I think that's my whole point, is we've got to make sure we're being understanding of it. And in the cases where somebody, my point about the one case where the guy's waving the gun, the officer, I'm not saying he didn't shoot. That was an officer who refused to shoot because he thought the guy was trying to commit suicide by cop. And he tried to talk him out of it. He was fired for doing it. That's what I objected to there, is that they're firing him for refusing to do it. I think when you come to a situation like this, I mean, there was a thing after the Castillo killing, a YouTube video went out and showed 3 different clips of white guys with guns, one of whose, 2 of them were taunting the police. One guy's got a assault weapon, assuming semi-automatic, and he's waving it around, not pointing at anyone, but waving it around and saying, I got a right to carry this, and he's taunting the police. Oh, come on, you can't do that. And he taunts the police, and I keep thinking, Castillo, we can't know everything that happened there. But Castillo, in his case, tells the policeman what he thinks he's supposed to do. I'm carrying a gun. If he was going to shoot the cop, I assume he's not going to say, I'm carrying a gun. He was trying to do what he thought was right. And I understand errors happen. I understand there's tough calls to make. And I think we've got to be highly sensitive. That's why I said in that march that day that I really liked it, that people were chanting the name of the guy who was killed in a very respectful way, giving him dignity. But I said, then you get to the charges of prosecute the police, no justice, no peace. And I'm saying, you know, these are, it's a complicated situation. So I think you're exactly right to be telling us, hey, don't be thinking these folks are doing it. I want to make sure, though, that we have the officers who are trained as well as possible not to jump faster than they need be. And as I said, I don't think they should have prosecuted these guys who shot the mentally ill man. I think they shouldn't have been getting commendations for good work when just because the judgment, that was the whole point, trying to prevent the escalation where it comes to that. In the Jamar Clark case, you know, once you're wrestling on the ground and officer feels the guy is grabbing for his gun, I understand that's too late then. The question is, how can we prevent it from getting there? So I think your points are very important and very good ones. I don't think I'm disagreeing with you. I don't know that most people would be. But, yes?
I like your question of how can we prevent this from getting there, and it kind of goes back to what I believe your name is Chris said at the very beginning, how faith plays a role in all of this. But it is also interesting to think of the privilege that we have, especially in this space. I know that examining our own privilege is a really hard thing to do, especially in terms of like how our privilege interacts with where our faith is and where our faith lies. But we all made the choice to come to this today. And I don't know if after we leave this room, if we're going to make a choice again to do anything about all of these things. And that's a privilege that we have. It's something that, you know, I can read it on my phone or in the newspaper that this has happened. I can see that there are protests. I could go to those protests. But why is it that there are only certain people that stand up when these things are faced? And I think the biggest movement that needs to happen is, like Chris was saying, there needs to be a change of heart. But how can a change of heart happen when there is still so much... exclusion's not the right word, but you know, you look around this room and it's very white. Granted, Holden is a Lutheran place, so we're, you know, tentatively Lutheran, and Lutheranism in America at least is very white. But what's it like when we go home and in our congregations? I know my home congregation has two African American families. How do we start this dialogue when sometimes it feels like it's us and them?
Right. Good points. By the way, I wanted to get back to one of your points, too, and you mentioned it briefly, and we haven't really spent much time on it, but that is the concealed carry and the not concealed carry rights and the stand your ground laws. I'm one, and I think most police officers that I hear are kind of split on it. A lot of them are very concerned about more and more of the people they're supposed to be policing are armed. We get more and more and more guns in society. Not hunting rifles, but people carrying guns in their purses, in their things, and so on, and the risk of that, and we haven't really talked about it, but you mentioned, yeah, law enforcement's gotten much more dangerous in recent years because Minnesota used to be very, very few people had permits to carry. You had to get, it was the sheriff's discretion, and certainly in any of the big cities, you couldn't get a permit to carry, and they changed it to they shall issue them. Even if you've got certain conditions that I'd argue, domestic assault, conviction, I'd argue some of those cases shouldn't have them. And that's a whole other issue, though. But, yes.
Can you explain what a stand your ground law is?
The stand your ground laws, which I think the Trayvon Martin case was related to those things. And that is if you feel any threat to your well-being, you don't have any obligation to retreat, you can use deadly force against somebody. And in the George Zimmerman case, he was hunting down this guy because he thought the guy was in trouble. He's chasing after him, and we don't know all the details of what happens, but he was clearly telling the 911 dispatcher, I'm going to go do it. And the dispatcher says, no, just leave him alone. And he goes chasing after him, and he shoots the guy. that in effect, even though he's running, he's standing his ground. He's not, he's at fear for his life or his well-being, and so he has the right to do it. There are various laws. Minnesota, there's a huge push in the last couple of years to try and tighten up, make those laws looser so you have more grounds. You don't have to have an imminent fear of death or serious bodily harm. You have to be afraid that you're going to be hurt. And you have, that's the attempt that they want to do. If you're afraid, you have no obligation to retreat from your car, from anywhere else. Normally, the expectation has been in society, if there's some dangerous person coming at you, they might hit you, I mean, whether they're armed or not, they might hurt you or something. If you can back off, you back off instead of standing your ground. Because the laws don't prosecute somebody. I mean, I've never heard of somebody being prosecuted for defending themselves. But they want to make it clear you have more right than that. But I don't know if others have more. I don't know other states. I've just been tracking the laws in some states where it's been a big push to do that.
In Texas, there's one where it's property specific. So if someone comes on your property, you can shoot them.
Breaking into your home.
Oh, not even.
No,
on your property.
Just on your property.
And that's the fear. I mean, with some of the, they call it the castle, your home is your castle, castle doctrine. It's the terms they've been using in Minnesota for that. And then the question is, well, take political candidates or kids trick-or-treating or other things. Normally, it's been kind of, you have every right to protect yourself, but you try not to hurt other people. You should be trying to back off from it. Other comments on this or any of the, yes?
I guess one thing to look at potentially going forward is maybe redefining the role of what police should be responding to. In the case of a mentally ill person, people are calling for assistance. Why send them a law enforcement officer there to do it? Maybe it should be someone else responding that handles it. And at the same time with some of these traffic stops, maybe that just should be completely removed from their jurisdiction. Why are they writing tickets or anything to begin with for a broken taillight or expired tabs or anything like that? You know, that person's not really a threat or harm to anyone else. Should police just be there to respond to assaults or, you know, domestic disputes, some of that nature, where that physical training that they already have may come into more play.
The more dangerous situations.
Need to escalate them.
And that gets the whole issue a lot of communities have. Should we, how much do we go for minor violations? How much do we enforce on little things? Because the little things lead to bigger crimes in theory. In many cases they do. But the question is, you're saying, should police be going in situations and enforcing things like that?
It's too much being asked of.
Yeah.
I was going to go back to the comment about Justine Damon, who was the woman in Minneapolis who was shot when she called 911. I don't live in her neighborhood, but I have two neighborhoods over, and so there's kind of one degree of separation. And I don't think we certainly don't know everything yet about what happened. There weren't any eyewitnesses, as far as I understand. But the response of her family was really interesting in the neighborhood, and Justine was really involved in an organization called the Lake Harriet Spiritual Community, so it was a faith community that was focused on meditation and wellness. And her family, in a press conference, just came out and said, "We are not angry about this. We want to show compassion. We feel compassion for the police officer, who is a Somali American." So there's some really interesting, we can call it that, dynamics about this. But I think it's this weekend in Minneapolis, this family and the community is putting on a, it's not a celebration for life, but it's an affirmation event to bring the community together. So back to Chris's comment about how hearts respond to this. It's been interesting to watch that. And yeah, she was a white woman, and the police chief was then fired in the wake of this, but I think those political tensions had been building, and there were union things going on as well. But it's been pretty heartening, I guess, to see the family responding in the way that they have.
On that point about the compassion for both sides, I think that's the case in most of these. I mean, when you have people with guns, accidents do happen, and mistakes happen. And you know, let's take the Philando Castile case, I kind of get the sense from what I've been tracking, and I didn't go to the courtroom or anything else. I'm not into that sort of thing, but you kind of get the sense that the officer who shot him minutes later was thinking, oh, what in the heck did I just do? And I panicked. And they're never going to admit that, and our judicial system doesn't allow you to do that. It means you're saying I am guilty. But you get the sense that the more guns we have in society and the more of these situations, the more we're going to have, which is why trying to de-escalate and trying to address gun issues is a very important one.
Are you aware of a movement in Minnesota to end gun violence? I know that Christopher Bishop has been strong in advocating.
Yes, there have been a number. I mean, I think many states, Minnesota's got a group of, I don't know if it's a Lutheran minister who's now in head of a group in our state called Protect Minnesota, which is trying to address gun violence. I think it was interesting when Gary Mason, the guy from Northern Ireland who was here last week, I mentioned that 15, 20 years ago when Northern Ireland was still in the midst of some of the killing, they had a program where they were taking 12 and 13-year-old Northern Ireland kids and sending them to stay in Minnesota for a summer so they get some tension-free time so kids can be kids and so on, and calculate how many the risk of being shot in Minnesota was significantly greater than the risk of being killed by some bombing or whatever in Northern Ireland. I mean, it was multiple times as many people killed over that period of time. That doesn't mean it's not a different sort of situation. One, it's a community, two communities clashing, and because of who you are, you're targeted. And in this case, it's not quite random, but it's more random seeming than that. So, anyway, we have a couple more minutes, but we'll one more. Yes.
So I'm a police officer and a patrol officer, and I've been doing it about 14 years, and I was a community service officer for 8 years before that. And I'm a background investigator and a field training officer. And so our department in Eugene, we go through crisis intervention training. And that's with psychiatrists and social workers. We also have a street crisis team. That's social service agency workers that work with us.
It's I met a woman who was here a couple weeks ago who worked in that program there. And
it's called CAHOOTS.
Yeah, yeah.
And it stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. And so there are calls that they will go to first, and then there's other calls that have a more safety issue that we would go to first, and we maybe hand those right off. It's kind of back and forth. They call us sometimes when things are out of control, things that they can't control. So that's a good system. It started out with just one shift a day, and the city has been able to fund it now, so they have 24-hour coverage, which is really good. And so we go through quite a bit of training, but besides the training that we go through, the experience that we have is every day at least 25% of my calls are due to some mental health related issue and dealing with people in crisis. And so the people that often are training us only have contact with people in clinically controlled situations.
Right,
rather
right.
Than people
it's
who
different
are active,
in the real world.
Right.
Yeah.
And then as compared to us who have experience with acting people in mental actual crisis on the street. And so I'd ask all of you to think about, you know, here, you know, none of us are locking our doors of our rooms, and we do feel safe here. But did you lock your car door at Fields Point, or did you lock your car or your door of your house when you left? And that's because of your experience and what you know could possibly happen. You hope it doesn't, but it could, and you'd be foolish not to. And part of it, you know, you talk about training, and that's a good part of it, but it's also the experience, what we experience in contacting people in certain situations, and You know, my goal is to go home safe every day and to see my family. And I can't afford to let my guard down,
right.
Or I could get killed. Or I could get someone else killed, an innocent person killed, like a citizen. And so I have to take all those things into account, oftentimes very quickly, where I have to make a decision in a second or two, where people have days and weeks and months to talk it over. Well, you should have done it this way and done it better. And as long as we have human beings doing this job,
there's going to be mistakes, right?
There's going to be mistakes.
Right.
And when we do things criminally, we should be held responsible. We also have an auditor system in our city where it's an independent auditor, where complaints go in and filter in through him, and then they go to our internal affairs, and that auditor classifies those complaints. And so that helps for accountability with the community. The only other thing I'd like to mention too is that it talked a little bit about what the community expects of police, and one of the things that has failed is the police are made to be responsible for dealing with the mentally ill people on the streets that our society is failing in dealing with adequately and treating and funding properly. And it's laying it on our feet to solve those problems and just put a Band-Aid on it.
Yeah.
And then we take them down to called the Johnson Unit, which is a psych ward in the hospital. And sometimes they're just right out. And you know, when we put them on a hold. And so it's a very complicated thing. Sometimes I have time to do traffic stops. But most of the time I'm going from call to call to call. And I'm just trying to do the best I can, you know, and I'm trying to always search for how God is working through me, through my discernment and my way I can use my discretion.
Thank you for sharing it. You said you're from Eugene?
Eugene.
Yeah, the woman who was here a couple weeks ago was working with the Portland police that way, and it sounded to me like there, and I hope in Eugene, that the use of these crisis intervention teams and so on is being done there, because in Minnesota we have the same thing, but too often they're not being called. They're saying, we're not getting calls, we're not doing it. And I really hope that's the kind of thing where best practices in one place slowly move out. I know with domestic violence, Duluth, Minnesota, 30 years ago had the new Duluth model, which was that if you confront a domestic violence, which is another very dangerous situation for law enforcement to go into, that even if both of them say, oh, there's no problem here, they were not going to leave without arresting somebody. That was a radical idea 30, 40 years ago, and now I think most departments in the country have some similar kind of policy. But so anyway, I'm glad to hear that that's going well. The other one I wanted to thank you for mentioning, and that is that we're using our law enforcement system, we're using our jails for mental health issues. And if we address chemical dependency and mental health, both of them as healthcare issues, and really address them, which we as a society have totally failed on, one, it would cut crime, but two, it would also make us all safer in our communities. I mean, we failed to address it. Anyway, I wanted to thank you. I think we're out of time right now. I'll be around this evening and another day for it, but thank you for your attention and look forward to it.